Tuning in. You know, just to show you how crazy the world is, we live in Newt Gingrich now is leading in some of the polls. Who said this today? This is kind of like T-ball. The Republican Party's nominating process, it's kind of like T-ball for five-year-olds. Everybody gets to hit. Everybody gets to win. There's no losers. Everybody step up. Now it's Newt's turn, huh? God have mercy. And Newt is just grinning. Oh, my God, he's just grinning. He got that big old, what passes for a smile on his face. And I think he knows full well that he has as much chance of becoming president as Herman Cain does. A statement from the former Marine Scott Olson, who was shot in the head by Oakland police during a demonstration. When was it? About 10 days ago. He said on Sunday he's feeling a lot better. In a message posted to Google Plus, Olson thanked those who had been tracking his progress and for their support. He wrote, quote, "I'm feeling a lot better with a long road in front of me. After my freedom of speech was quite literally taken from me, my speech is coming back, but I've got a lot of work to do with rehab." And at the post to Google Plus, there's a picture of Olson smiling with a neck brace and a scar on his forehead. And he went on, he said, quote, "Thank you for all your support. It has meant the world to me. You'll be hearing more from me in the near future, and soon enough, we'll see you in the streets." End quote. Now, he was released from the hospital last week. The police chief in Oakland, Howard Jordan, has opened an investigation into the circumstances surrounding Olson's injury. But officials there have not said how they think this guy was shot in the head. You know, how many videos of the shooting are out there? 6, 10, 100? How many times have they been viewed at YouTube? Come on, Oakland, for Christ's sake. You do everything wrong. I'm talking about the administration and the cops. Olson, of course, served two tours in Iraq. He worked as a technician. He apparently earned a handful of service medals. Friends say he finally figured out what military life was all about. And after he left the service, he started a website. It's now defunct, but it was called I Hate the Marine Corps, which served as a forum for disgruntled servicemen. So he's out of the hospital and posting messages. Now watch how long will it take some right-wing thug to zero in on the nature of his discharge from the Marine Corps, huh? Were you watching Bill Maher last week on Friday? I didn't get a chance to see it, but somebody sent me something that he said. I want you to hear this. This is interesting. This is Maher speaking. Somebody needs to explain to the Republicans that Ebenezer Scrooge is supposed to be the bad guy. And before conservatives start whining about another war on Christmas, they must admit they hate everything about Christmas, because brotherhood, goodwill toward men, and especially charity make their skin crawl. Now this week, Michelle Bachmann proposed cutting huge holes in the federal safety net, demonstrating a total misunderstanding of the concept of a net. Here's what she said, quote, self-reliance means if anyone will not work, neither should he eat, end quote. Merry Christmas to you too, crazy lady. Yeah, that's the first thing I think whenever self-reliance comes up. Punishment by starvation. Honestly, who can hear that statement and not think of Scrooge, who in A Christmas Carol suggested if the poor don't want to go to the workhouse, they should get on with dying as a service to population control. Now, if Herman Cain said that at the Republican debate, he would get a standing ovation. And say what you want about Ebenezer Scrooge, he never shoved Bob Cratchit's head into his groin and said, look, you want a job? You want Christmas off or not? Newt Gingrich refers to Obama as the food stamp president because Obama doesn't want children to starve to death, the effing commie. Mitt Romney says we should let the people about to lose their homes lose them, and then they can just become renters. And Mitt said the same thing a few years ago when the automobile industry was tottering, remember? Let it die. I find it ironic that Republicans have such disdain for the lazy, and yet their solutions to every problem is do nothing. The answer to wealth inequality? Do nothing. Healthcare? Do nothing. Climate change? Nothing. Racism? Doesn't exist. For a group of people so head over heels in love with self-reliance, they sure do recommend a lot of just sitting around on their asses, you know? If A Christmas Carol was performed by the Tea Party Dramatic Society, it would be a cautionary tale about how the hero, Scrooge, a blameless job creator, is turned into a socialist through the corrupting influences of Tiny Tim. And the play would end with a simple, plaintive question from Mr. Scrooge. Just how much of my wealth does Mr. Tim think he's entitled to? And that is the great Republican fallacy of this election, that our economic problems are due not to Wall Street's gambling, but because too many Americans are lazy. But there are 16 million unemployed, and we only created last month 80,000 jobs. The problem isn't laziness, it's math. But this is where the Republican Party is now, in favor of people dying because they don't have health insurance, in favor of people letting people go unfed if they won't work, and if they want to work, but are Mexicans, in favor of putting up a fence that electrocutes them. Even Scrooge is thinking, look, I hate the poor, but I'm not an effing psychopath. But that's where this party is. It simply has no bottom. Except Marcus Bachmann. He's a bottom. Bill Maher. Also got from Danny a little poem, The Devil and the Koch Brothers. Listen up. The devil dined with the brothers Koch. Boys, he said, I like your style. You pull those strings behind a cloak and embrace the darkness with a smile. The brothers drank the wine and dreamed a dream of empires rich and vast. And with their dinner guests, they schemed and gave a toast to oil and gas. The meal's on me, the devil said. I'll see you boys in the by and by. And there was scarcely a moment's dread or thought of the camel and the needle's eye. Danny Farragher. I like that, Danny. Thanks. Okay, we have a break coming here. When we come back, the new Mitt Romney plan is to throw veterans under the bus, veterans who are no longer of any use to the capitalist system. Matter of fact, they become a severe liability, just like the workers. The veterans come home after defending capitalism and want things like a job, health care, someone to help them get over their PTSD. Well, Newt has a solution. Population. Krugman the other day pointed out something that I didn't know had happened. Mitt Romney's latest really bad idea, unveiled on Veterans Day, is to partially, that means completely, eventually, partially privatize the Veterans Health Administration, the VA, the VHA now they call it. And as Krugman points out, in this country, you can, you know, the way our health care is delivered is pretty diverse in terms of how it's paid for and delivered. And as he says, many of us effectively live in Canada. Some live in Switzerland. Some live in Britain, you know, referring to these different programs. And some live in the unregulated market of conservative dreams. And as a result of this, we have plenty of evidence about what works and what doesn't. So naturally, politicians, mostly Republicans, if not exclusively Republicans, are determined now to scrap what works and promote what doesn't. That's the Republican way. And that brings us to Mitt Romney, his idea to privatize the Veterans Health Administration. And as Krugman points out, what Romney and everyone else should know is that the VHA is a huge policy success story, which offers important lessons for future health reform. As Krugman writes, many people have an image of veterans' health care based on the terrible state of the system over 20 years ago. Under the Clinton administration, however, the VHA was overhauled and achieved a remarkable combination of rising quality and successful cost control. And survey after survey have found that the VHA provides better care to its clients, its patients, than most Americans receive who are not veterans. Even as the VHA has held cost increases well below those facing Medicare and private insurers. And furthermore, the VHA has led the way in cost-saving innovation, especially the use of electronic medical records. So, what's behind the success? Well, as Krugman points out, the VHA is an integrated system which provides health care as well as paying for it. So, it's free from the incentives created when doctors and hospitals profit from expensive tests and procedures, whether or not those procedures actually make medical sense. And because the VHA patients are in it for the long term, the agency has a stronger incentive to invest in prevention than private insurers do. And yes, the VHA is a perfect example of socialized medicine. Perfect. Although, as Krugman points out, some private systems like Kaiser Permanente share some of the VHA's virtues, but it works. The VHA works. The socialized medicine works and suggests that what it will take to solve the troubles the U.S. healthcare system has more broadly. So here comes Mitt Romney believing that giving veterans vouchers, these goddamn people are vouchers. Everything's got to have a voucher. Education voucher, healthcare voucher, veterans administration, a voucher. Here's a voucher. Food, here's a voucher. Voucher. Yeah, give the veterans vouchers to spend on private insurance, and that somehow this is gonna bring better results, right? Why? Well, Republicans have a thing about vouchers. You know, Paul Ryan earlier this year introduced his idea to convert Medicare into vouchers. Yeah, vouchers. Romney's Medicare proposal, vouchers. The claim, Krugman points out, the claim always is the one Mr. Romney made last week, that private sector competition would lower costs. Uh-huh. We have a lot of evidence about how private sector competition and health insurance works, and it's not lowering cost. He goes on, he says, to be fair to Mr. Romney, he takes a somewhat softer line than others in his party, suggesting that the existing VHA system would remain available and that traditional Medicare would remain an option. In practice, however, partial privatization would almost surely undermine the public side of these programs. For example, one problem with VHA is that its hospitals are spread too thinly across the nation, right? This problem would become worse if a substantial number of veterans were encouraged to opt out of the system. Which all comes down to a final thought that Krugman pointed out. Maybe all this amounts to a case for Rick Perry. Any Republican would, if elected president, set out to undermine precisely those government programs that work best. But Mr. Perry might not remember which programs he was supposed to destroy. Mitt Romney's plan, the latest in this lineup of crazy people that are passing themselves off as serious candidates for the presidency. You know, say what you like about Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, and God knows I have. But you remember the debates several years ago, 3 years ago, between those two. Do you think there was a possibility that one of them would have said, Libya, you know, I rest my case. I mean, these eight Republican nominees are just, again, it's amazing that we've come to this point in our political history that Americans are willing to accept this slop as candidates for the presidency of one of our two political parties. It's astonishing. From Prairie 2, Mitt's 11-11-11 plan, or why the likes of Newt Gingrich, or why the likes of Newt Gingrich is passing him in the polls. Prairie 2 leaves out a lot of little words, like of, to, the. That's all right. It's okay. Prairie 2 writes, the stock market trailed off today with the realization starting to sink in that just putting lackeys of the bankers in charge in Greece and Italy isn't really going to help. The new nails in that coffin are that Italy is still paying above 6% to sell bonds, and now Spain is above 6% as well. The right wing continues to decry the welfare states of Europe, but the numbers don't show that to be the problem. There are countries in northern Europe with much stronger social programs that are doing just fine, as they aren't trapped by the euro. The eurozone rules allowed excessive amounts of capital to flow into certain countries where the return was larger, and now bond traders are looting and pillaging these countries as they must pay these debts back in a currency that doesn't match the output on their economies, but rather that of the German powerhouse. The political right, when faced with such facts, falls back on racism. Like, Southern Europeans are lazy, corrupt, and don't pay their taxes. Well, the Irish, too. You know what they're like. Free college education, please. That's a sin to the right wing. Spain is, of course, full of Mexicans. And Portugal is... Where's Portugal? They speak Portuguese in Brazil. It must be in another South American commie country, right? Somewhere near Venezuela! The only Eurozone country with any real problems is Greece. And its only real problem is that corporations don't pay their taxes. Otherwise, the Greeks could cope. The rest of this mess is entirely a result of bankers and hedge funds. These countries do bear responsibility in that they don't throw the pirates out like Iceland did. I mean, Iceland, the entire population, would make a good-sized town anywhere else, and they stood up to them. That's a hint that we don't have to give into them either. Mitt Romney came out Friday with his 11-11-11 plan. It's not a tax plan like Keynes, but that was the date he commemorated so eloquently by announcing his intention to throw all the military veterans under the bus. He has seriously proposed doing away with VA medical and replacing it with vouchers to buy private insurance. In other words, only veterans who are wealthy enough to meet the copay required to get insurance will get health care. Now, this would be a big moneymaker for Republican crony insurance companies and a knife in the back for those who paid for freedom with their bodies. And a P.S. to Mike Malloy. Let it go, Mike. It's what they thought they were doing. I know that. Already, 500,000 Iraq-Afghanistan vets have gotten VA care out of 2.5 million who have been deployed so far. Mitt is only following the Republican Party line. The sick should pay for their own care, and only then a huge profit for other Republicans. You can forgive Mitt, or not, for his lack of understanding and empathy for the plight of veterans. He did his service during the Vietnam War with several years of missionary work in the Provence wine region of France, also known as the French Riviera. Remember, he was a Mormon missionary. In the 2008 primary season, he basically lost Iowa by telling a veteran who challenged his support for the Iraq War, while nobody in his family has ever served, Romney said he was, in fact, a real patriot. His response to the vet's challenge was that, quote, none of my five sons need to serve in the military as they were doing their patriotic duty by working on my campaign, end quote. Jesus, God, oh no. Holding a French chateau against the onslaught of communism is as close as most modern Republicans ever got to serving their country anyway. Avoiding war shouldn't be held against them, except that they are more than willing to sacrifice your children for the very profitable racket of war. PrairieNumeral2.com. Yeah, I couldn't believe it when I read Krugman's column this morning. I guess I missed over the weekend the whole Romney thing of vouchering medical care for veterans. Oh, yeah, that'll work. That's a good idea. That's a really good idea. People that have, arms and legs blown off, half their head blown away, brain damage, psychological damage so deep that it's going to take, 20 years of therapy to fix. Yeah, give those people vouchers. Right. And let's see, what would the vouchers be? $1,000 a month? Would that work? And then they could go shop around and find health insurance with a private insurer. And 38% of the $1,000 a month would go for administrative costs and bonuses for the, you see what I'm talking about? It's this kind of stuff that tends to make certain people start to think murderous thoughts. You know? Speaking of health care, ta-da! The Supreme Court today agreed to hear a challenge to Obama's signature legislative achievement, the, what is it called? The Affordable Health Care Reform Act. Oral arguments are going to be heard by March, and probably a decision in June coming, which will put a decision right in the middle of the 2012 presidential campaign. Now, I can tell you right now, you know how this is going to work. If the Supreme Court rules that it is constitutional, the Republicans will be lucky to be left, in office in county commissions and dog catcher roles. If the Supreme Court, though, decides that it's unconstitutional, you can see the ads, the political ads that'll be run by every single filthy, slimy Republican attack machine on earth in order to bolster whoever the Republican nominee happens to be. So the Supreme Court is about to show us, if it votes on the Republican side, the conservative side of this issue, there are more than one way to rig an election. You don't have to declare the voting to be stopped in a certain state. You can rule on something like this. And you notice how they conveniently waited until this year to hear it. Huh? The Supreme Court has scheduled 5.5 hours of argument instead of the usual 1 hour. So the clash here is between the federal government and the 26 states that together filed a challenge to the law. The justices agreed today to decide not only whether the mandate is constitutional, the ability of the federal government to tell you you have to buy health insurance, but also if it's not constitutional, how much of the balance, the rest of that law, the Patient Protection Affordable Care Act, that's what it is, must fall along with it. So the Supremes have a really interesting job ahead of them, don't they? Huh? And now I know what you're thinking, you little cynic, you. You're thinking about those five right-wing neo-fascist judges, all of whom are Catholic, I think. Aren't they all Catholic? I believe all the fascists are Catholic, which is not surprising. But I wonder how many of them are child molesters, too. But here they are, ready to make a decision that will have a profound influence, not just on what happens to healthcare in this country, healthcare delivery, insurance, healthcare insurance, whatever the hell you want to call it. But to what extent the neo-fascists running for various offices will be able to use this issue to point out that, you know, the foreign-born president is so, so out of touch, he doesn't even know how to write a constitutional law. Down on Orleans Avenue.
Seekers, it's time for your humbled and obedient servant, Mike Malone.
10 before the hour, Michael and Roswell wrote, all of what Krugman is saying was true until the Bush administration instructed the military to trigger the records to inhibit military and VA care to traumatic brain injury victims and PTSD sufferers in order to help keep the costs down enough so that the public would not complain about the costs of war, thus enabling the production of yet more PTSD and traumatic brain injury sufferers. If there's a contemporary problem with the VA, it's a matter of policy, not the system itself, something that neither Romney's nor Gingrich's plans would address. These bozos, Michael writes, and Romney in particular, think that there's nothing in this wide world on which their Wall Street cronies should not be able to profit. Even the misery that results from war. In their view, that is what's wrong with the VA. It would be more laughable but for the fact that both of them avoided the opportunity to become veterans themselves. And yet, now that they are once again trying to wedge themselves into a position of power, they're experts on veterans. And the more things change, the more they stay the same. Romney is still a vulture with great hair, and Gingrich is still what he has always been, an overinflated dirigible of a politician whose unalloyed greed for power shines like an aura around him, a figure at once so ridiculous and so odious that derisive laughter is the only proper response to his presence anywhere, anytime. Michael and Roswell. Yeah, Gingrich is just, I keep saying this about these Republican candidates, but pick one, any one, and tell me a similar character in some other enterprise. You know, just pick one. Michelle Bachmann reminds me of, what was her name, Kathy? The woman that played Nurse Ratched, Louise Fletcher. She does. Bachmann, except Bachmann does have kind of a demonic little laugh, but I try to think of comparable figures outside of politics that these people could be compared to. And in that sense, they are unique. Truly. I can't think of anyone else who could say that the half-witted nonsense that Herman Cain says. Oh, my God. When, what was the thing, Milwaukee Journal Sentinel? Did you see that video yet? Where they ask him a few questions, and you think Rick Perry's silence, unable to come up with the third agency that he would cancel as president. If you think that was bad, you should see this thing, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And it was Cain that invited himself in to talk to the editorial board. They said, sure, come on. They set up a camera and asked him a few simple questions. Oh, my God. Apparently, during the debate on Saturday in South Carolina with these clowns, he said that Obama's reaction to the Arab Spring, the uprising, democratic uprisings in these Arab countries earlier this year, North African countries, that Obama had allowed the movement to go in the wrong direction. Allowed. Which is a weird statement against democratic uprisings. You know, that somebody 7,000 miles away allowed it to go a certain way. Okay. Cain said, you have to look at Libya, Egypt, Yemen, and all of the revolutions that are going on and how the Obama administration has mishandled them. As a result, Cain said, this has gotten totally out of hand. Are you listening to this? He said the revolution in Egypt where citizens throughout Hosni Mubarak, that revolution, in Herman Cain's opinion, could strain relations between the United States and Egypt. He said, quote, our relationship with Egypt may not survive It turns out that the opposition was more of the Muslim Brotherhood, which could end up with a majority of control of this new government, end quote. Kane criticized the Obama for his support for protests in Yemen, where the government there has responded with violence and killing the peaceful protests. I don't know. There is no surprise here that a Republican contender for the presidency would side with fascist dictators. There's no surprise there. None at all. But as one poster at, I think it was Huffington Post, said, he probably thinks Arab Spring is a bar of soap. And Kane's outdated foreign policy outlook is arrogant, it's dangerous, it's riddled with deadly unintended consequences. It was never for us to assert any kind of control over the so-called Arab Spring or handle it. And from a foreign policy standpoint, we'll never learn anything if we feel we have to push the river rather than understanding other people and what they value. But that's Herman Cain. That's all these Republicans. This is really, it's the sub-basement. It's down way beneath the hold of the ship, down where the slop and the filthy seawater and the dead rats float around. That's where they got this group. You know what I'm saying? Truth Seekers. If you'd like to join in. Herman Cain's wife says the sexual harassment allegations facing her husband just don't make sense to her because, quote, he totally respects women, end quote. Wow. She was interviewed. I don't know why they brought his wife out, Gloria Cain, but she was interviewed on Fox, of course, by Greta Van Susteren. And she said she couldn't believe the charges being levied against him. Gloria Cain told Greta Van Susteren, quote, I'm thinking he would have to have a split personality to do the things that were said. End quote. Really? No, Gloria, he doesn't have to have a split personality. All he has to do is just have a lot of time out on the road by himself and be in a position of power and, you know, be a businessman and have access to a lot of women who might desperately need some help getting from point A to point B. No split personality needed at all, Mrs. Cain. None. She went on to say, you hear the graphic allegations, and we know that would have been something that's totally disrespectful of her as a woman. All I know, the type of person, and I know the type of person he is, he totally respects women. Uh-huh. Okay. All righty then. Mike is in Peoria, Illinois. Hello, Mike.
Hey, good evening, Mike.
Hi.
Hey, I just wanted to run something past you there. By and large, I don't trust a Republican.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, and this wasn't with the South Carolina debate, but what about Huntsman? I was wondering what your take on Huntsman was with his comment about the banks with the, what was it, $9 trillion, 6% GDP, and that being held by, you know, basically six banks. Hear from a Republican, and I'm sure their jaws dropped when that came out.
Well, there have been a couple of things said in these so-called debates that were kind of intriguing coming from Republicans. But the one thing that stands above all others where it concerns Huntsman, which might make him a viable candidate, is that he speaks fluent Chinese. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And since China is going to be, this is the Chinese century, 2001, we are in, or 2011, I get my brain, I'm Rick Perry. We're in 2011, we are in the 21st century, and the 21st century belongs to the Chinese, so it might be good to have a chief executive who speaks Chinese.
Who can talk with him, that's right.
Now, I'm not saying that there's not a Democratic candidate out there who couldn't learn Chinese, but Huntsman already speaks it. And in fact, he's the only one that has really a true foreign policy experience. Newt Gingrich will claim to have foreign policy experience, but he got his flying around on Air Force One with Bill Clinton back in the 90s. Newt Gingrich has no foreign policy experience whatsoever. As a matter of fact, he's very parochial in his worldview. He likes to come across like he's a know-it-all. A big ass blowhard, but that's about it. He's so I don't know your take on Huntsman might make some sense, Mike. Are you thinking about voting for him?
No, not at all. Hey, and I was going to say, enjoy the show. I listened to you back when you were on Chicago back. What was it? Late 90s?
Yeah, 11 years ago. I left.
Just keep tuning in. I find you here and there, and tune you in it. Tune you in and then enjoy the show in general.
Well, thanks. I appreciate that, Mike. Thanks a lot. Take care, pal. I appreciate you checking in here. John Huntsman. I don't think so. Chris is in Raleigh, North Carolina. Hello, Chris.
Hey, Mike. Yeah, this is Chris in Raleigh. I spoke to you just a few days ago about the Occupy Raleigh and the Occupy Party thing that was coming up. Well, I just want to give you an update on it. I didn't know if you were too interested in it, but I figured I'd try anyway.
Sure.
Well, we decided to go through with it, and it's gaining a lot of support.
Now, refresh the audience again. What you have in mind?
Yeah, we just wanted to kind of create something. I guess parallel to the Occupy movement, but there's just a lot of dissent in regards to people just kind of sitting around, not really trying to do too much. So
something that has you're thinking about something that has some organization, some stated goals,
leadership
council or leadership, however you want to constitute that, but something other than what you're seeing now.
Right, exactly.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
That's a brief description of basically what kind of is going on. So we went ahead and started. We had a good meeting last weekend, and we're having kind of our platform meeting on this Saturday.
Right. Now, when you say we, who are you referring to?
Just members of the Occupy Raleigh movement who
okay.
want to go in this direction as well.
Right.
There's a multitude of people, but
mm-hmm.
that's who I'm referring to when I say we.
Mm-hmm. Have you heard anything from other Occupy enclaves or gatherings around the same issue?
Again, the one city that I keep kind of hearing about is Cincinnati. I hear that Cincinnati is doing something similar, and we found some articles about the Anonymous group pushing for the formation of a political party. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how deep that goes, but that's some of the rumors going around. But mm-hmm. I haven't seen anything too big, nothing really national outside of perhaps the Anonymous movement, if you want to consider it that. But Cincinnati, again, I think that's the biggest one I've heard of outside of what we're trying to do as well.
Well, I've got mixed emotions about it, and I'm sure that a lot of people do. The Occupy movement, if out of that movement comes a political party, all right, that's one possible outcome. Another possible outcome is that the Occupy movement will just create the space, so to speak, where a political movement will form, but without the Occupy protesters who created the space to begin with, because it's from what I can gather from being around it and finding out what I can about the Occupy movement, it is not necessarily policy oriented. It is just look what has happened in this country, and it's time to stop. It's time to get capitalism or corporatism, however you want to put it, out of our government, a system of self-government, out of so many of the areas where it's penetrated. So a political party developing from the Occupy movement, or a political party developing within the space that the Occupy movement created, those are two different things. I know it right. sounds like a distinction without a difference, but not so. There is a real difference here. I'll tell you what, I've got to do a break here. Let me put you on hold, and I'll come back. We'll talk just a little bit longer and get your opinion of that, whether or not a movement, a political movement, i.e. a political party, should come from Occupy or just from the energy created by Occupy. We'll be right back.
You know, I've memorized Lerner and Golden. I feel like I'm almost a Jew. But when it comes to times like Korea, there's no one more red, white, and blue. So love me, love me, love me. Democratic Party, they want the UN to be strong. I attend all the Pete Seeger concerts. He sure gets me singing along.
He's a liberal with a microphone, and that makes him dangerous. It's Mike Malloy.
21 past the hour. Back to Chris and Raleigh. All right, as briefly as you can, Chris, tell me, do you think that Occupy movement should evolve into a political organization, or should it just create the space, let the political organization develop and fade away?
I think it's important that the Occupy movement moves politically in some way, whether it tries to form a third party or it tries to influence political parties that exist. In some way, it's got to get its message more directly into the political system. If it's going to criticize the political system, I think we've got to interact with the political system. Mm-hmm. So I think that's the overwhelming majority viewpoint on it. At least the ones that agree with at least making it somewhat political.
I don't know. What about the argument, though, that the Occupy movement is not, as they have stated from day one, is not a political movement? How do you... work around that or work through that or work from that, if it's not a political movement, then how will it be possible to turn it into one?
Well, the consensus that has come out of GA meetings is that it's not a political movement and it's leaderless. But my own experiences in life, is a fundamental human need that I've grown to know, is that people look for leadership. They look for someone in a group of people amongst a group of people. Someone is inevitably coined the de facto leader of anything. I think it's a human need. Being in the Army, a veteran, I saw it there, and I see it now. And I think that's a key piece of what this movement's really missing. If it had good leadership, then it could be taken in many different directions. It could be taken to a third political party.
But is
or
it?
Or it could just be. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, I met people at the Occupy DC or the Parallel Movement, October 2011.org, that would make excellent political leaders or candidates and yet the consensus, or not the consensus, the full out, full blown statement is that's not what they're about. That they're not about seeking election to office. That what they're about, and this is where I think there is essential difference between or among the attitudes about the Occupy movement. I think the core of Occupiers is to simply stop the machine, to stop this monstrous, rapacious, vicious corporatist machine that has taken over everything. And in order to do that, the last thing you would want to do would be to continue to participate in the system that the machine now owns. And if you are forming or thinking of forming some kind of a top-down political movement, then you, by definition, because of where you live, you have to take your movement into the maw of that machine. And it will then, if history is any kind of a teacher, it will then devour you. So the Occupy movement, to me, my interpretation is only my interpretation, although it probably agrees with other people's, but the Occupy movement is not about that. It's not about, in any way, shape, or form, forming yet another political entity that runs the risk of being totally corrupted by the system. It's the system itself that has to be brought down. And not in the sense of, like the Russian Revolution. I mean, we're not talking here, I don't think, I hope it doesn't come to this. We're not talking about a bloody revolution. We're talking about a bloodless revolution. One can hope. That may be naive on my part. But the Occupy movement, as I've come to understand it, is not a political movement. It is apolitical.
And that's absolutely correct. And there's different ways to look at a revolution. There's different ways to change things. To be honest, the backing of what we our group has created are Occupy movement people that came up with it, that started it, or they were here at the beginning of Raleigh.
No, I understand. I get that from your first phone call. Let me suggest this. Chris, I've got to move on, but I want you to keep calling in, if you would, please, because I'm real curious about how this works out with Occupy Raleigh in general and you specifically. But I'm sure these ideas have come from the GA meetings. It's not coming from an outside source. I understand that, but I'm just wondering if it is. I'm not wondering. I mean, I'm thoroughly convinced it's not in keeping with what Occupy is about, which brings us to that other thing I was telling you about. Maybe the Occupy movement's goal is to create a space where political leadership can develop. And the way you do that is smash the system that now controls everything. Chris, I got to leave it right there, but we'll talk again, I promise. As you say, is yours.
that you deserve it. Help us to preserve it, or being free will just be rights and nothing more.
I do not like them in my nation. It's more Mike Malloy.
Before the hour. Bill is in Oakland, California at the Occupy Oakland. Bill, welcome to the program. I don't know if you heard any of that conversation with Chris from Raleigh. Did you?
Yeah, I kind of agree 100%, Mike, with what you were saying. You concluded it. I mean, a lot of people are calling in for the radio talk shows now. The progressive ones are saying that the Occupy movement needs to get behind a political persuasion of one form or another. And as you eloquently articulated, the Occupy movement, people are getting frustrated with it. I mean, it's only a month and a half at the most old. People are getting frustrated with it because they claim that there is no leadership, there's no organization, there's no structure. But what we're trying to do is to try to solve some of the immediate problems that are confronting your everyday Americans, okay? If in my view, I don't think we should join the 1% machinery, all right? So we set up a fringe group or a contingent group that goes and tries to affect policy and legislation up at the Beltway. Okay, but I don't think you're going to succeed because what the Occupy movement is trying to do is they're trying to shift the paradigm. Mm-hmm. You know, we're not trying to tweak or skew the system to the benefit of all. Got to shift this paradigm is what we're trying to do. So it's kind of like a revolution in consciousness. It's not like any other movement, as I'm sure you're aware of.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so we're battling the forces of capitalist consciousness that has to be destroyed. We can't move forward in this system by just short-term jump into the and become a third party, and you know that's not going to work.
Right.
It's not going to work because the objectives of the Occupy movement are not status quo. It's not 1%. Democrats, Republicans, that's 1%. Why would you want to join that?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't have the. I mean, how are you going to contend with that massive amount of money and corruption? How? I mean, the Occupy movement is not that. I'm talking to your fans. Like the Occupy movement is not that big yet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we don't have media behind us. We took tremendous demonization out here with Occupy Oakland when that guy got shot. Had nothing to do with the camp. And they're saying that oh, he was in the camp, and his parents said he was in the camp. And, you know, they've been wanting to, and they raised the camp.
Right.
They've been coming to dismantle. They raised it with tremendous violence. Okay, so, and you're talking about, well, we need a political party. Some people say we need to get behind a leader. Well, get behind who? Who? Get behind who? I mean, we have problems that have to be solved immediately.
Well, I think sure. This is one of the problems now that is going to present itself in the Occupy movement. Aside from the pressure of the police, the political system, the corporatists who are now demanding that the police clear these areas. Aside from that, there is the internal fact, I think, of the Occupy movement, where I think Chris in Raleigh was right that people within the Occupy movement are now starting to say we've got to turn this into some kind of political power. Now, as I said, I think that is misguided and misdirected, not because I say it. I'm, you know, oh no, but because of what the Occupy movement, as I understand it, is all about. You know, I wouldn't presume to tell a movement that I had nothing to do with as it's being born, which direction it should go. And if I am to believe, and I do, the people who were speaking for the Occupy movement, i.e. just people who were there, then the Occupy movement, as you and I seem to be on the same page, is not about organizing something or redirecting attention towards something or becoming just one more cog in this horrible ass wheel that just keeps turning and turning and grinding and grinding. I don't know why people who may be coming up with this idea don't just all you have to do is just go back to what Mario Savio said all those years ago at Sproul Plaza. Just go back to that.
That's what the camps are doing, Mike. It's like people come to the GAs, they listen to the GAs, and they go home. They go, oh, I don't agree with that. Or I do agree with that. You got to get involved with the committees. Go to the workshops. Like you said, we have discussions on political theory, the history of protests in America. You got to get knee deep in it, and then you can see. I mean, they even destroyed the kitchen, man. I mean, feeding homeless people. Now, what is wrong with feeding homeless people? What do you need a leader for to feed homeless people? Right. You know, people have to think. You know, you got to sit down and think. You know, like if you see somebody who's homeless, you try to help them. I don't need a leader for that. You try to help them.
Well, I think what you're touching on, I think everybody should understand this. You're touching on the very heart and soul or the essence of the Occupy movement. Somebody said one time, where are the Occupy leaders? And the answer was look in the mirror.
Exactly.
You know, it does not take leadership to acknowledge homeless or hungry or war makers or corporatists who are devouring the system. You don't need a leader for that. And I think what has happened, Americans especially, and maybe other societies, cultures are suffering the same way, but we've come to believe that that we can't make decisions from the bottom up, so to speak, that there has to be a leader. Then he has to appoint a committee, and then the committee has to have subcommittees, and then the subcommittee's got to hear testimony from witnesses, and then there will be expert witnesses on both sides. The bottom line of all that is nothing. Nothing happens. It's just...
Yeah, I mean, look what a mess right now.
Right.
I mean, you know, but one thing I am for, though, and I'm going to bring up the next GA once we get reorganized, that I am for dismantling the camp. I am for dismantling the camp because I think that we can move forward, at least in Oakland, much more without having a camp. The camp has been used as an excuse by the businesses and by the police department and by the city to demonize the movement.
Yeah, the camps are a focal point. The camps now, just by very nature of what they are going to attract people who have absolutely no interest in what you're doing, but do have an interest in other things. And those other things are going to be used to paint the entire Occupy movement. So I agree with you. It is time. And every Occupy group has to come to their own decision themselves.
Yeah.
But I think it is time to dissolve the camps and maintain the energy, I think people have figured out now, oh, my God, it is the system itself. It is not finding a way around the system. It's not finding a way to penetrate the system. It's not finding a way to overcome.
Yeah.
It is absolutely bringing the system to a complete halt. Are you there? Are you okay?
Yeah. I worked in Silicon Valley as an engineer for many years. I made a lot of money, and I'm involved with the Occupy movement. I'm based on the social media team, and I basically set up the Wi-Fi hotspots for them, okay? So, because I've been homeless once upon a time in my life, so I know what it's like. But, it's like, you're right, Mike. That I'm not interested if you want to join capitalism. I'm not interested in it. You know, I'm just not. I know here in Oakland, these people are really trying to help to solve an immediate problem. Yes, if you want to do the political party thing, go ahead. You want to vote for a third party, go ahead. But you're not going to get anybody to support that, the masses, at least in many of these cities, until you solve their hunger problem and their homeless problem.
Mm-hmm.
That's a fact. That doesn't require any analysis. You know, I mean, that's just, I mean, there's a lot of problems that we have at the local level. And people are changing, Mike. I mean, like, the media focuses on the guy who got shot, but what about the other homeless people that have gotten involved? I talked to guys in the camp who were on the streets, and they are now politically involved.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, they're actually politically involved, but nobody talks about that.
Yeah.
You know, and that's important. Those little moves, no matter how small it is, those guys and women are now involved like never before.
Well,
it's also a good thing.
It is a dynamic movement for sure, and I just hope it doesn't start to calcify into the usual channels, because with a couple of notable exceptions, and I think the most notable is the civil rights movement, but with that as an exception, so many movements that started out devoured itself. You know, that old expression, revolution eventually devours its own child.
And, exactly. Well, lesson from the 60s and 70s for sure.
Right. And that has, I've seen that happen so many times. I have a feeling that if the Occupy movement can keep itself immunized from the well-intentioned, I'm sure, people who want to direct the energy, focus it rather than let it radiate. The energy has got to radiate, and that means you don't focus it. You focus it down. Yeah, you wind up with a laser. You can carve things. But if you have it radiate rather than focus, I think the effect is going to be what the original Occupy movement was all about. And with that, Bill, I've got to leave it there, but I hope you're going to stay in touch, please.
Yeah, I'm going down to University of California. Birthday has now been occupied, and they were also raised too. And the video is out there. You can go to occupyopen.org and look at some of the live stream there, and you can see all the
details.
Yeah, that's taking place.
All right. Thank you, Bill. Stay in touch. We'll be right back.
Wake up and smell the java. Sit up and pay attention. Stand up for what you believe in. Speak up. Tell somebody listen.
Yet tonight, how much he hates these people. It's Mike Malloy.
Ten before the hour. Next hour, we're going to do a dramatic change in the subject matter and tone of the program. We are entering into the one of the most perverted times of the year. By perverted, I mean a time of the year that has had so many different religious and non-religious organizations designate the significance of this part of the year to their particular belief system. And all of those have become totally perverted. This is another example of how the capitalist or the corporatist machine has walked right in, you know, with a lot of help, apparently, from some of the organizations, some of the religious belief systems that that declared the end of December was going to be, an intersection of all these different religions, some of them old, some of them new. And you know, the idea of spirit has been totally purged. It's gone. We're going to talk about that a little bit. And how to offset that. How you don't have to participate. This is what the Occupy movement is talking about. A way that you can celebrate your end of the year celebration, whatever it is, whether you're pagan or Christian or Jew or whatever you are, how you can celebrate spirit. Rebirth, renewal, if you want to. That's what I'm going to talk about next hour. It's a little bit different from what we normally talk about, but stick around. Martin is in Berkeley, California. Hello, Martin.
Hi, Mike.
Hey.
I've been to both the Occupy Oakland and the Occupy Cal here in the Bay Area.
Mm-hmm.
And I spoke at one of the open forums at Occupy Oakland, and I feel very strongly that the best way and maybe the only way that the movement can affect meaningful change is for it to, by consensus, identify the changes that need to occur and then state that this huge, this enormous new voting bloc, and it is huge, will only vote for candidates that pledge to make these changes. And so it doesn't need to create a political party. It doesn't need to put out its own candidates. It just needs to essentially develop a platform by consensus and then let the candidates come to it. Because as you've said a couple of times in the last hour, the system is the problem. There are structural changes. Changes have to occur. And the changes, you know, short of a revolution, have to happen within the system. But I feel that that's the way to do it.
Well, let me ask you, just from an historical standpoint, has that ever occurred? Has there ever been a system that I think we all agree, even some D-baggers, a system that has become so corrupt, so violent, so murderous as the system of imperialism and domestic policy, foreign policy, as our system has become? Now, I know that rubs raw on a lot of ears, but it is the damn truth. I mean, we've had examples of this just in the past 10 years of stormtroopering into two different countries, one of which we have utterly, the cradle of civilization, we have utterly and absolutely smashed into just a bloody shards of death and destruction. So if people don't like to hear that the greatest, I mean, Martin Luther King said it, Noam Chomsky has said it, the greatest purveyor of violence on the face of the earth is the United States. I know that's hard. That's hard, man. That's what Brother Dave called a hard saying. Those are hard sayings, but they're the reality. So let me ask you then, after that little explosion, do you know of any system as corrupt as this one that has ever changed for the better because a movement decided to try to change it without ending it?
Well,
because that's not a challenge. I'm not challenging you because I don't have the formal education necessary to flip through all the notebooks in my head and say, aha, here's one. So my question is just a question. It's not a challenge.
Well, I can't think of one offhand, but I still think, in principle, what I've stated can happen. I think that for every person that's in the street, there are thousands or tens of thousands, maybe, I don't know, hundreds of thousands of people who, in principle, or agree with the intentions of the movement.
Right. I agree with that, for sure.
And its strength right now, at least, is in its numbers. And I think it can use that strength by stating it, you know, essentially a platform. It doesn't even, it could be one or two or five changes, you know, pick the most important ones that need to be made. And by consensus, you know, take a little time to do that. And then I think if you just put that on the table and just, you don't have to demand exactly, you just state, these are the changes we think or believe need to be made, and we will vote for candidates who pledge to make those changes. Politicians who are in place, most of them won't, because they're too entrenched in the status quo. But I think some might gravitate to it, and other new ones will rise to the occasion. I don't know. That to me seems like the way to go.
Well, that certainly is another avenue. We had Chris and Raleigh, who had ideas, and then Bill in Oakland, and now you, Martin in Berkeley. And I think out of all of this discussion, all these different ways to go, if everybody can just keep in mind what the common goal is, Martin, and the common goal is to exactly what Mario Savio said all those years ago, what Martin Luther King said all those years ago, it is to stop this machine, to stop it. And if there's some way to do it from within the system, or as a challenge from without the system, or and let the machine remain intact one way or the other, okay, that might be an idea. But I hope you'll stay in touch. Martin, I have to leave it right there, right now. Thanks a lot, pal. And please stay in touch with us. We'll be back after the break. I'm Mike Malloy. 7 past the hour. Don't forget, Friday is a rebroadcast. No, Friday is Brad. Brad will be filling in for us on Friday. And then all next week. So if you tune into the Malloy program and you hear Brad, no, he didn't. There wasn't a coup. He didn't. It's not Occupy the Malloy show. It's Brad Friedman filling in. I think it's all next week, except Thanksgiving. So show him some love, all right? Speaking of holiday season, whether, I don't, you know, whatever you celebrate, Christmas, Hanukkah, Kwanzaa, solstice, or something I missed there. I guess that pretty much covers, is there a Muslim or a Hindu holiday around the end of the year? Probably so. Anyway, it's a good time to mention this because, as you know, the mega machine has already started. You can't walk into a mall. You ever notice how close that word is to the word M-A-U-L? You can't walk into a mall and get mauled with these days without, you know, the Christmas stuff is already up. And it's so weird. I don't know how this affects you, but the older I get, you know, the more I remember what I was told as a kid in the Methodist church that I attended as a kid. Unless I was at my grandmother's, then it was a Baptist church. But when I attended the Methodist church as a kid, I was told over and over again about the humble beginnings and the poverty and the homelessness of Jesus and his parents, well, the unborn Jesus, really. And, you know, I was told about the message as a kid, about how the man Jesus tried to tell people a very simple message. And it had nothing to do with voting Republican or gun ownership or no taxes. You know, it's become so perverted. It really has. You know, if you're a regular listener to this program, you hear me bust up on Christians all the time. And I know that's very, very difficult for dedicated Christians to deal with, to hear someone like me on the air. I get plenty of emails. Why don't you attack the Jews? Why don't you attack the Muslims? Well, there's really no reason to in the context of the U.S. culture where this Christianity, this perverted form of Christianity, is constantly, constantly shoved in everybody's face. There's no mention of abortion in the Bible. There's no mention of gay marriage. You know, there's no mention of you got to be on the side of the oil companies and against global warming. And yet all of this has been twisted into, you know, by the usual punk suspects. Twisted into some kind of a sick hybridization of what these people now call Christianity. But, you know, there was a time, really, wasn't there, when the humble aspect, the poverty aspect, the homeless aspect of Jesus's birth and you know, traveling to Joseph's hometown to be taxed, and so on and so forth, you know, which it's gotten so far afield. I've told Kathy many times that I, up until a couple of years ago, 3 or 4 years ago, we used to find a Catholic church and go to Catholic Mass because I liked it, the Midnight Mass. I liked the medieval quality to it, the weirdness. Even though, as you know, as the priests and everybody walked down the aisle, especially if you went to the one of the big Catholic magnets churches here in the Atlanta area, even knowing that probably half those priests walking down the aisle were child molesters. There was something about the medieval quality of it. And I'm sure back in medieval times, they were child molesters then, too. I mean, this is not a new phenomenon. So, but there was something, if you could block your mind from all that vile ugliness of organized religion, there was something about the medieval quality of the high mass that was fascinating to me. Not in a sense of, ooh, save my immortal soul, you know, none of that crap, but just that this tradition had carried down over two millennia. You know, to me, it was like, whoa, that's pretty cool. And, you know, in a perverted kind of way. I have to admit it was a perverted kind of way. And one year, a couple of years, we went out to a monastery east of Atlanta, a real honest-to-God monastery run by, I forget what the order is. Do you remember, Kathy, the order of monks at the monastery?
No idea.
I don't either. But we went to a couple of their Christmas Eve midnight masses, and that's really getting down to the gristle and the bone. It's really something to see. So anyway, all of that, just to say, with this horribly commercialized season now begun, you know, and the term Black Friday, you know, the day after Thanksgiving is supposed to kick off the selling frenzy. This consumer buying frenzy. I mean, it's really sick, isn't it? I mean, when you see the videotapes of people being crushed as they storm through the doors of Walmart or Target or where, you know, Macy's, whatever it is, it's so degenerate. It is so astonishing to watch, to know that on Thanksgiving night. And with a lot of retailers, you don't have to do that this year because they're going to start their Black Friday on Thursday, on actual Thanksgiving evening. But to watch those videotapes of crowds, enormous crowds gathering outside the real temples of worship in this country, and that is or are the big box stores. Those are the big box stores. It's not the Catholic Church. It's not some little out of the way Protestant church someplace. Nah, that's garbage. You know, that's just that's where you go to impress the neighbors. The real temple of worship for the Christmas holidays is at your local mall. So to watch that, though, even recognizing that perversion, to watch it, there's something about it every year that just gives me like the cold shivers. Kind of like watching feeding time at the zoo, you know, when they go to the lion enclosure and throw in these huge chunks of dead animal or, yeah, God knows what it is. And you watch that primal, beastly attack of these huge chunks of flesh. And for some reason, I can't separate that from what I see on my local television channels about how so-called Black Friday begins. Black Friday being, well, it's the first time this year we've been in the black ink. Yay for Jesus. Sell, sell, sell. Buy, buy, buy. And I'm hoping that this year the whole thing collapses. If there ever was a year, except for the 1%, the 1%, they can continue their buying orgy, forever because, you know, they own it all already anyway. They're just swapping it back and forth among themselves and exchanging, you know, their pieces of silver. But for the other 99% of us, I hope the whole thing collapses this year. Wouldn't you, seriously, deep down in your heart, I don't care what your religion is or if you're atheist, wouldn't you like to see the whole thing just collapse? The whole Christmas, commercialization just collapse totally. And completely just collapse into dust and spider webs and choking fumes and just watch the whole goddamn thing come down, crashing to the ground, boom, and be done with it. And then in its place, for people who really try to follow the message of Jesus from 2,000 years ago, the man who, the rabbi, the Palestinian rabbi who wandered around with 12 dudes and tried to get everybody, hey, listen up. Don't be greedy. Don't beat up on each other. You know, try to love your neighbor, you know. And, oh, by the way, of my 12 disciples here, 3 of them are gay, so let's not do the gay thing, all right? Let's just everybody be cool, be happy, be friends, be nice. It's rough. It's hard to live here in the Middle East in the year zero, if y'all are going to start, you know, counting the years from my birth. But chill a little bit, y'all. Now, that didn't happen. Well, at least there's no record of that happening. But I got something for you when we come back you might find interesting. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
substance, no abuse.
21 past the hour. Okay, that's Kathy's attempt at humor, I guess. No Christmas carols. Come on. But anyway, we're talking about that, about the holiday season. I'll call it the holiday season. And the, not just the easy to target hypocrisy of the whole thing and the insanity that it's become, but the equally easy hypocrisy on the part of the right wingers who scream, keep Christmas in the shopping season, you know? When people, remember a couple of years ago, they started these right wing crazy bastards. If somebody say, happy holidays in the store when you bought your purchase, you know, there they are. The Christmas police run by real hypocrites who, would beat Jesus to death in a second if they saw him at Occupy Wall Street or Occupy Portland or Occupy Oakland. You know, they would be on Jesus like white on rice and just stomp it into a bloody heap and kick him to the curb. They did it before and they would do it again. The right wingers. That's what they're about. You know, Rush Limbaugh and Hannity and Savage, well, Savage Jewish, but, the rest of these people would fall on a Jesus character and murder him instantly and dismember him and toss him to the sharks. That's what they are. That's what they're about. Any allusion to Christianity on the part of these people is pure hypocrisy. Pure hypocrisy. But now that we have declared all of that, I have for you here a great way to put spirit back into this perverted season. Spirit. Now, I'll tell you how we do it before I share the list with you. The way we do it here at the Malloy family. Kathy and Molly and I have a couple little traditions that have developed now. Developed because we have a kid, obviously. You know, you don't really get into traditions, I don't think, unless you have children or nieces and nephews that you can... because it is a kid... day, isn't it? I mean, it's all about the birth of this little baby and so on and so forth. But what we've done, there's a place in Georgia, in west central Georgia, Callaway Gardens. It's a former plantation, that's right, of a real wealthy right-wing white Caucasian family, the Callaway family here. They sent a couple of their family members to Congress, so on and so forth. I mean, real hardcore right-wing types. But, you know, as the family aged over the generations, a huge chunk of it was turned into a place called Callaway Gardens. And in the spring and the summer, it's really beautiful. It's just, I don't know how many thousands of acres, but it's huge. It's a typical Caucasian plantation that was left over, you know, from Civil War days. But in the during the Christmas season, they do a festival of lights throughout this huge wooded section of west central Georgia that is pretty spectacular. Some of it is very Christmassy in the sense of the religious aspect. Some of it is very pagan in the sense of fairies and elves and sprites and woodland creatures. Some of it is... you know, kind of commercial with those commercial iconic figures that have developed in this country, like Frosty the Snowman and Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer and, you know, characters like that. So all in all, though, it's really a treat. You get on what's called the Jolly Trolley, and there are hundreds of them. And you're on an open-air bus with no sides. And you're pulled by a pickup truck. You go very slowly through this huge, I mean, you know, it takes a good hour to make the journey through all the lights. And you do it at night, and it's just gorgeous, you know. And Molly has loved it her entire life. Kathy and I love it. So that's one of the things we do. We go to Callaway Gardens for that event. We also go to the Atlanta Ballet's production of The Nutcracker. And we do the version that the George Balanchine version is the one that we like. And then a third thing that we do, let's see, we do that, and we do those two things. And what's the third thing? Do we go to, you remember?
The satanic altar in the basement.
And, no. Stop it.
No, we have a Christmas party.
Right, that's right. We have a huge Christmas party. Build a satanic altar in the basement. You've been married.
Well, that's for all the teabaggers who are listening, who are just sure that we are worshiping the devil somewhere in our house.
You've been married to me way too long. The cynicism has just absolutely permeated every pore in your body, hasn't it? But that's the way to do it. And then the third thing is a big solstice winter party that we have here at the Malloy homestead. You know, we just invite a lot of people. We have maybe, I don't know, 100 people come, and Kathy does all the food prep, and the house looks like something from, you know, Macy's department store window. it's all, you know, winter solstice-y. So we have our winter holiday traditions here. We're not just grumps that sit around during the season and go, I don't believe any of this crap. You know, we don't do that at all. We don't follow the religious part of it, but we follow the fun part of it. Now, when we come back, I have a list how you can put spirit back into the season. Stay with us. I'm Mike Molloy.
Him dangerous. It's Mike Molloy.
25 before the hour. All right, here you go. Here's some things you can do to put the spirit back into your year-end holiday season, no matter how you celebrate it. But I think especially if you're a follower of the man Jesus, you might be interested in this. You gotta let your family members know this. If you all get together for Thanksgiving or, you know, if not get together, just make phone calls. Happy Thanksgiving, Mom! You know, if you do that, you can tell family members what you expect from them this Christmas and what you're going to do and what you do not want to happen this year. So here's a list to jumpstart your imagination. First, tell them this holiday season, in your home, things they make themselves will be more highly prized than anything they might buy. That's a gentle way of saying, don't buy the crap. Come on. Make me a potholder. But, you know, make something yourself. Second, if you think you're not handy or you can't make things, cook it or recycle it. And then buy things which other Americans made from local shops, which are American-owned and operated. You know, there are all kinds of small businesses right in your neighborhood, especially artisans. For God's sake, help an artist. Next, as an example, buy your gifts from local artists, farmers markets, bakers, craftsmen and craftswomen, candy makers. Try to get gift certificates from local barbers or hairdressers or restaurants or car detailers, you know, gym, local theater tickets. Once you put your mind to it, that list it becomes endless. Fourth, let everyone know politely but firmly in no uncertain terms that mass-produced stuff from Bangladesh or Hermbuktu is not acceptable this year, that you're just not going to buy forced labor or sweatshop or slave-produced goods. Just don't do it. You know, and stop listening to these bastards that say that the what's wrong with the economy is that people aren't buying stuff from Wangbuktu. And you know, it's our fault because we're not going out getting in debt. Tell them to kiss our collective Christmas ass if necessary. Just don't do it. Fifth, this holiday season, share the wealth, what little there is left of it, with those closest to home. Don't support corporations who ship American jobs overseas, and which just increases the profits for the scum 1% that we're all supposed to be rebelling against, at least if not in Occupy meetings and campsites, at least in our hearts, right? So if neither this filthy Congress or our very frightened president can create jobs in America, show them how you can pitch in to do your part. Just don't buy from these big corporations. Tell them to go to hell. You can do it. Number six, it's time that we, the 99%, begin taking care of ourselves. And the best way to cut out the middleman, the top dogs, the fat cats, and the foreign producers who run out-of-sight sweatshops using child labor is to ignore the bastards. Seriously. Spend your money where it stays in America, where it circulates in America, where it creates jobs in America. This is not hard stuff, truth seekers. And that goes down even to things like Christmas wrappings made overseas. Yeah, you ever notice that? And you notice how cheesy and crappy it is? Now, come on. If you're over, I don't know, pick a number, 40. If you're over 40, remember the Christmas wrapping when you were a kid? And then look at the Christmas wrapping you used last year, how you try to wrap a box in it, and it tears, right? Because ever feel how thin and cheap and cheesy it is? Here's a better idea. Start saving the Sunday comic sections from your newspapers. Not the New York Times, Washington Post. They don't have any, I don't think. I don't know about the Post. But, you know, your comic sections from newspaper. Use that for wrappings for Christmas. It's made in America. It'll be recycled in America. Huh? Isn't that a good idea? Next idea, stop shopping at Wally World and these other big box franchise importers who have for decades forced American companies to open plants outside the U.S., exporting jobs for more profit to the 1%. And after they choke on the mass-produced imported stuff they ordered back last summer, you can pick up things at pennies on the dollar after New Year's to put aside for later gifts like birthdays. If they can manipulate the market, so can we. Don't buy it! Let this crap sit there. You know about after Christmas sales. All right, make these rat bastards eat this stuff. You know what I'm talking about. We'll go down to Atlanta and go into a Macy's a week after Christmas. Holy jumping baby Jesus. There are cashmere sweaters in there that in the run-up to the celebration of the baby Jesus, they were selling for $120. Now you can get them for $25. You get my point. Think about that for a second. What happens from December 21st, when a sweater costs $125, to January 3rd, when it costs $25? What happens to make that happen? Yeah, think about that. Huh? Boycott anything made or sold by right-wing Tea Party financiers like the Koch brothers and Art Pope. They own Roses and Maxway and Value Mart and Super 10. And those are owned by Variety wholesalers. There's a good, there are all kinds of lists that you can find online of these right-wing American corporations that produce junk from their overseas plants. And then bring it back into this country and put it out there all shiny and plasticky and you know, with colored lights on it. Here, buy this, buy this, buy this. Don't. Don't. Next idea, get to know your extended neighborhood. People right here at home who spend their lives making beautiful things, whether they're potters or weavers, musicians, glass blowers, book writers, organic farmers, bakers, florists, woodworkers, cheesemakers, balloon twisters. I mean, it goes on and on. On and on. Now, another part of all this, of course, is turn off the goddamn television. Turn it off, at least when kids are in the room. Don't look at it. Especially this time of year, it is designed to get inside a person's head and just twist reality into just unimaginable shapes and forms that have to do with consuming and buying and getting. And when the consuming or the buying or the getting can't occur, then there's guilt, anxiety, fear, hatred. My God. You know what I'm talking about. You know what I'm talking about. Another idea, buy used things. Used things? Sounds like Herman Cain. No, no, think about this for a second. Buying used things sends no profit back to the manufacturer, no matter where. Doesn't make any difference. It's right up the street or in China. No profit goes back to the manufacturer when you buy used stuff. Yard sales, thrift shop, friends. You know, when you do that, you're sending nothing back to China. And you're supporting people right here in the U.S. Next thing, during the Great Depression, which my parents lived through, so did my grandparents, so did yours, they survived by doing exactly this and more. You know, just buying locally, buying used stuff, buying old stuff. When new was not available or not affordable, they repaired, fixed up, repainted, and made usable things out of discards. I can remember, you know, I've told Kathy the story, and she just looks at me and gets tears in her eyes and says, oh, my God, it's like you were the children in the Christmas Carol. I said, no, there were times when I was a kid. I remember one year in particular, we couldn't afford a Christmas tree. So my two younger brothers hung out down at the corner in Toledo. It was a corner gas station on our street. And they'd set up a Christmas tree lot there, somebody had. And my two brothers went down there on Christmas Eve and begged the owner for all the branches that had been cut off and had left behind. People didn't take with them to make garlands or wreaths or whatever. And my two little brothers, I think they were 7 and 9 or 8 and 10 at the time, they got armloads of these branches. I had left home by this point. I know the validity of this story. But they took the all these armloads of Christmas tree boughs and branches and took them in the alley behind the house where they had a 2x4. And very meticulously, they took hammer and nails that they got out of my old man's toolbox, and they nailed these branches onto this 2x4, this 6-foot length of 2x4, nailed branches on until they had built a Christmas tree. And then on the bottom of that 2x4, they nailed two pieces of wood crosswise to each other so the thing would stand up. And then they took it up into our little tiny apartment, and lights that were left over from a couple years before, they draped over this tree. Well, when I saw that, it was at once heartbreaking. But also, I had to admire my two little brothers, because even though there was no money for a Christmas tree, they made one. Before the hour. Okay, just a couple more. We're just trying to give you some ideas here that I think are great, great ways to put spirit back into the Christmas, Hanukkah, Kwanzaa, solstice season here at the end of the year in this tired, sad country of ours. Regifting is in. You know, you've got stuff in your closets, in your attics. I know we do. Full of stuff. That you don't use anymore, you don't like anymore, or you wonder why you bought it or why someone bought it for you. You know what I'm talking about. Stuff that someone gave you and never used. And maybe you know somebody, not to dump junk on somebody else who doesn't want it, but remember, if you re-gift, there's no money changes hands. It goes back to enrich the 1%. So it may be something that you go, ew, God, what am I doing with that? But somebody else might think, man, I'd love to have one of those. You know what I'm saying? So it's not like you're dumping junk on people. One man's garbage is another man's treasure or something like that. I don't know. Women, too, of course. But the only catch on that, if you got stuff in your attic, your closet, remember who gave it to you, because re-gifting is cool unless you re-gift back to the person who gave it to you. That's not cool. You can get hit over the head with a holiday wreath if you do that. Heirloom gifting is in. Now, by heirlooms, I don't mean heirlooms that the 1% has. I mean stuff in your home. I have, Kathy and I use it as a table. It's a little like an end table. And it is the sewing machine. What do you call it when you take the machine out? What, the part that's left, Kathy, what is that? The table, it has the leaf that flops over where back in the day they would lay the clothes they were sewing on. But this was my grandmother's. Oh my God! You know, my grandmother, who's been dead for over half a century, she got this around when sewing machines first came out. It's an old Singer sewing machine. Well, the sewing machine itself was taken out a long time ago, but we still have the table that it sat in. And it sits in a corner up in the attic, and I don't know, I've had it there for a long time. But to us, that's an heirloom. That's a direct connection to my grandmother. So the time will come when I will give that to one of my kids or one of my grandchildren as a direct link, you know, across five generations. I mean, that's the thing about heirlooms, right? And if you do that, write a little history of that piece of furniture or that little lamp or that little doodad that you're going to give somebody. Write a little piece of history so they know what it is and so that the history is preserved. Aren't these good ideas? These are not mine, by the way. This comes from True Blue Network. True Blue Network, it says here. Okay. And next one, while you're cleaning out storage areas to rediscover what's hiding in there, make a pile of stuff you cannot re-gift or make into something else. And give it to your local thrift shop. Those thrift stores. This is where Kathy and I, we get a lot of clothing. We'll buy a lot of Molly's clothes in there. Because, you know, especially when she was younger, because kids outgrow stuff so fast. We went to a gift shop the other day, or a thrift shop, I should say. Kathy found a red suede jacket, just stylish as hell. For how much?
$10.
When it was new, it must have been $350. It was a name label. Anyway, your goal is to reduce stuff in storage by a third, the stuff that you've accumulated. If you've been married for 15, 20 years like we have, the stuff that just shows up, it's just up there all of a sudden. It's up in the attic or it's in the basement. We rented a storage shed about 2 years ago and moved all kinds of stuff and then went on a frenzy last summer and reduced the storage shed by 80%. And then got a smaller storage shed. So now the only thing that we keep in the storage shed are Rubbermaid containers that have, I know they're probably made in China, Rubbermaid containers that have the Christmas decorations in and have the Halloween decorations in, all the stuff that's made in China, right? But little by little, you know, we are trying to practice what we preach. We are. And we're trying to teach Molly the same thing. What else? It's just that there's enough time left. There's about 6 weeks until the winter solstice holiday season. And that's plenty of time to, you know, dig around and take a look. And come up with ideas. I know nobody likes to do that anymore. Kathy and Molly and I go out and pick strawberries early in the spring, early in the summer, I should say, when they're first out. We go to a strawberry farm. And we'll pick great copious amounts of strawberries, and of course we'll eat a lot. But then Kathy will cook them down and make them into strawberry preserves. And then 7 months later at Christmas, you know, that's one of the things that we give to people, little gifts, homemade candy, strawberry jam. Your horrible. No, your fruitcakes are really pretty good, come to think of it. Of course, if you're in recovery, you don't want to eat one of her fruitcakes because it's soaked in rum. But there's all that kind of stuff. I don't know. I just thought I'd toss it out. Okay? Just, it can be such a fun time of year, and I hate to see it all corrupted by commercialization. I really do. I mean, that's been a pet peeve of mine for 40 years. 40 years. Okay, no more preaching. Thanks for tuning in. I'll see you tomorrow night. Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy.
Becky, thanks.